Imagine a young man, born in bondage, cast into the harsh slave system of antebellum South Carolina, who at just 23 would brave a daring escape, commandeering a Confederate ship under cover of night, and emerge a hero of the Union cause. That man, Robert Smalls, did exactly that. From the decks of the CSS Planter to the halls of Congress, his journey reshaped a nation struggling to define freedom. His life became a powerful testament to courage, ingenuity, and unyielding will. His story challenges us to rethink what is possible when one human spirit refuses to accept chains. So, if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. Chapter 1. Roots in the Lowcountry, Beaufort, South Carolina. The year was 1839, and the air hung heavy with salt and silence. Spanish moss draped from the oaks like mournful curtains, and the creak of a wagon wheel over clay echoed like a prayer no one answered. In a modest slave cabin behind a grand white house, a boy entered the world. His name was Robert Smalls. His mother, Lydia Polite, was a house slave of deep conviction. She was strong, resilient, and feared what this world might do to her son. From the start, Lydia knew Robert was different. Not only because he asked questions most children were taught to silence, but because he listened in ways most adults could not. His eyes observed everything. The way the master's sons held their heads high. The way the overseer cracked his whip just to remind the heir who was in charge. Robert watched it all and filed it away. His likely father, though never officially confirmed, was said to be Henry McKee, the very white man who owned him. Whether whispered in bitterness or sorrow, Lydia carried that burden quietly. She raised Robert with a kind of double-edged strength, the knowledge that he could be both loved and owned by the same house. She wanted more for him. She needed him to see beyond the fence lines. From a young age, Robert was allowed small privileges uncommon to most enslaved boys. Perhaps it was guilt from the master. Perhaps it was strategy. But at 12, Robert was sent to Charleston. Lydia begged them not to. She knew the dangers of the city. But what she couldn't have known was that this move would set everything in motion. Charleston, in the 1850s, was a world unto itself. Cotton wealth, ships from every continent, a bustling port layered with tension. Free black people walked the streets, heads held high. Enslaved laborers, like Robert, moved among them like ghosts, working, listening, learning. There were whispers of rebellion, of abolition, of northern states where chains did not rattle. Robert's new position was in the waterfront district, working on the docks, cleaning fish, loading cotton, and later assisting on ships. The water became his teacher. He learned the tides by watching the seagulls. He studied the stars, memorized the coastline, knew every sandbar like the back of his calloused hands. Charleston shaped him. It also showed him the cruelty of men unchecked. He was arrested more than once for being out past curfew. He watched other enslaved boys disappear into the fog after floggings. Still, Robert kept his head down and his mind sharp. One of his earliest assignments was on the Planter, a sidewheel steamer used to transport goods and military supplies for the Confederacy. His official role was deckhand. His actual role was observer. Every trip out into the harbor added to his mental map of escape. Every officer's signal, every password spoken in the dark, he remembered By the time he turned 23, Robert Smalls had married Hannah Jones, an enslaved hotel maid. Together, they had a daughter, Elizabeth. He knew he could not raise a child in bondage. The idea haunted him. He didn't want his little girl to grow up looking down when she walked or fearing the sound of footsteps behind her. He made a vow. If the right moment ever came, he would not hesitate. He would act, not for fame, not for war, but for freedom, real, breathing, undeniable freedom. He began to count the guards, note when the captain slept. He listened closely when officers changed shifts and memorized every detail about the harbor defenses. All he needed was one night, one slip. But even as he waited, the world around him burned hotter. The Civil War was underway. The Confederate flags flapped above Charleston rooftops. Cannons were being positioned at Fort Sumter. Fear was rising on both sides of the divide. And amidst all of it, Robert Smalls kept working on the planter, quiet and invisible, every day bringing him closer to the edge of something bold and irreversible. And Lydia, his mother, watched it all from afar. Her son, now a man, who once played barefoot in the yard, was becoming something this country was not ready for. A black man not just dreaming of freedom, but planning it. The Low Country had birthed many boys into chains, but Robert Smalls would not die in them. He was preparing for the night that would split history in half. And when it came, the world would never see him, or his people, the same way again. Chapter 2. Under Confederate Colors. The CSS Planter wasn't just any ship. It was the heartbeat of Confederate logistics along the South Carolina coast. Built for shallow waters and versatility, the Planter could carry troops, deliver ammunition, haul heavy artillery, and even tow other vessels through treacherous southern waters. But to Robert Smalls, it wasn't just a boat. It was a symbol, a floating fortress of iron and opportunity. By 1861, Robert had proven himself so capable on the docks that he was brought aboard the Planter as a deckhand. In short order, he earned the trust of the Confederate officers and was promoted to wheelman, essentially the ship's pilot, despite being enslaved. To white Confederates, he was just a skilled hand who knew the water. To the enslaved men working alongside him, Robert was a quiet leader, a man with a plan bigger than any mission the Confederacy could assign. The Civil War had exploded into full violence. Charleston Harbor was now a dangerous chessboard. Union blockades pressed in from the Atlantic, cutting off supplies. Fort Sumter loomed like a warning shot, still blackened by fire. Confederate ships, like the Planter, were tasked with maintaining control, moving weapons, carrying messages, and fortifying the southern stronghold. Robert understood the stakes. He watched as the Planter picked up guns from the docks, delivered them to outposts, and returned carrying cannons taken from fallen Union ships. And all the while, he took mental notes. He learned the Confederate signal flags used to pass through the harbor without raising suspicion. He memorized the schedules of every guard at Fort Moultrie and Fort Sumter. He paid close attention to the officers, especially Captain C.J. Relia and First Mate Samuel Hancock, learning their habits, weaknesses, and patterns. They trusted Robert too much. That was their first mistake. Each day, he stood at the helm, steering the Planter past gun batteries and blockades. It became clearer that the ship was his way out. But he also knew that escaping alone would be a hollow victory. If he was going to do it, he would take his family, and he would bring every enslaved crewman he could. Smalls had grown close to the other enslaved men aboard the planter, David Jones, Alfred Gourdine, and Abram Jackson among them. They shared whispered dreams in the engine room, behind smoke and soot, talking about freedom like it was something they could touch. Slowly, Robert began to involve them in his secret. Not fully, not yet, but enough to let them know that if they trusted him, something incredible could happen. Then came the moment that would seal everything. One afternoon, Robert overheard Captain Relaya say he and the white crew would be leaving the ship in the coming days for shore leave. It was rare, but not unheard of. The planter would be docked overnight at the southern wharf, unattended except for the enslaved crew. Smalls felt his heartbeat change. This was it. Over the next 48 hours, he made final preparations. He confirmed with Hannah, his wife, that she could meet him with their daughter and two other women at a prearranged point along the harbor. If the plan worked, they would sail to freedom. If it failed, they would all be executed. She didn't blink. "I trust you," she said, "but make it worth it." That night, Smalls could barely sleep. The ship groaned against its moorings, like it too sensed what was coming. Robert stood alone on the deck, staring across the dark waters toward the Union blockade. He could barely see the ships, but he knew they were out there, miles offshore, waiting. All he had to do was reach them. His thoughts drifted to Lydia. What would she think of her son now, on the edge of something so dangerous, so impossible? Then he thought of the men and women still trapped, their chains tighter than ever. He didn't just want freedom. He wanted to make a statement. That even within the heart of Confederate power, a black man could outthink, outmaneuver, and outwit an entire system. He gave one last look at the harbor's edge and whispered, "Soon." The next night, May 12th, 1862, the Confederate officers left just as expected. They didn't lock the ship. They didn't suspect a thing. And Robert Smalls, the enslaved wheelman, stood on the deck of the planter, staring out at the dark waters. The wind picked up. The harbor lights flickered. It was time. Chapter 3. The night of May 13th. The harbor was quiet, wrapped in a thick mist that made Charleston Street seem farther away than they were. Lanterns along the wharves cast flickering reflections in the water, dancing like spirits over the tide. It was just past 2 a.m. when Robert Smalls stepped onto the deck of the CSS planter for what would either be the most daring escape of the Civil War or a suicide mission. The white officers had left the ship overnight, confident the black crew would remain obedient. They didn't know Robert. They didn't know his mind had been charting this course for months. Every wake, every wave, every shift change logged in silence. Tonight, he would put everything on the line. Robert was dressed in a loose-fitting Confederate officer's coat and a wide-brimmed straw hat pulled low over his brow. He mimicked Captain Relier's posture and gestures down to the smallest detail. He'd watched him walk. He'd listened to his commands. He could become him long enough to fool the guards at the harbor's gates. He turned to his crewmates, trusted men like Alfred, David, and Abram, and gave them one last look. No words were needed. They nodded. Each man took his post. They had practiced their roles silently, invisibly. No rehearsals, no second chances. As the planter eased away from the dock, Smalls gave the first signal, a series of whistles and light flashes required to pass the Confederate sentry at Fort Johnson. The signalman didn't hesitate. He waved them through. To him, it looked like any other routine night. Robert's heartbeat pounded louder than the churning steam engine. His eyes never left the water ahead. Next came Fort Sumter, the largest and most dangerous checkpoint. Dozens of Confederate cannons pointed at the harbor like coiled serpents. One mistake here, and they would be blown to splinters. As the planter approached, Smalls lifted his arm and delivered Captain Relia's signature salute. He gave the correct flag code, using the same hand movements he had seen for months. There was a long pause. The silence dragged. A voice from the ramparts shouted something Smalls couldn't quite hear. Then, a response. They were cleared. No one aboard breathed. The ship moved forward like a phantom. Just beyond the forts, in the open sea, waited the Union blockade. But Smalls knew they weren't safe yet. A few miles out, the silhouette of the USS Onward loomed in the distance. She was a Union gunboat known for strict orders: fire on any Confederate ship that approached without a white flag. The planter was still flying the rebel banner. If the Onward fired too soon, they would die before they ever reached freedom. Smalls ordered the men to lower the Confederate flag and raise a white bedsheet, hastily sewn by Hannah the night before and hidden on board. They hoisted it high, praying the Union crew would see it in time. The Onward turned toward them, guns aimed. Then came a voice from the deck of the planter, loud and clear. "We surrender. We're unarmed. This is a prize ship." Union sailors stood frozen in disbelief. One officer later wrote that when they realized the ship was being piloted by enslaved men who had stolen it from the Confederacy, the crew erupted in cheers. They couldn't believe what they were witnessing. Small stepped forward, calm and steady. He delivered the planter to the Union commander and announced, "I thought the planter might be of some use to Uncle Abe." It was a line only Robert could have delivered. Part humor, part courage, entirely history. Word spread fast. By sunrise, newspapers across the North were printing the unbelievable story of the black man who stole a Confederate warship and delivered it to the Union. Robert Smalls became an instant hero. President Lincoln himself took notice. The daring act helped shift public opinion in favor of allowing black men to serve in the Union Army. Robert had not only escaped, he had changed the course of the war. But for Smalls, the most important moment came when he held his wife and daughter in his arms later that day. They were safe, free, no longer property, no longer shadows. That night, as the sea rocked the ship gently and Union soldiers buzzed with disbelief, Robert looked out over the water. He wasn't just a fugitive anymore. He was a pilot in more ways than one, navigating not just ships, but a new future for his people. The daring escape from Charleston Harbor would become legend. But for Smalls, it was just the beginning. Because once a man proves he can defy the impossible, the world will never see him the same again. Chapter 4. Turning Tide in the War. The moment Robert Smalls delivered the planter to Union forces, everything changed. For him, for his family, and for the war itself. The Union Navy was stunned. Here was not just a ship, but a fully functional Confederate military vessel, turned over intact by a crew of enslaved men. On board were not only the ship's artillery and ammunition, but also Confederate naval codes, maps of mines laid in Charleston Harbor, and intelligence on troop positions and fortifications. Robert Smalls didn't just steal a ship. He delivered a strategic gold mine. Union officers quickly realized his value went beyond that one moment of bravery. Smalls was more than a pilot. He was a tactician, a translator of the enemy's secrets. And soon, he became one of the most vital civilian assets to the United States Navy in the Southern Theater. But before he could serve further, there was an urgent matter to settle. His freedom. Just days after his arrival, the U.S. Congress passed a private bill authorizing the release and full manumission of Robert, his wife Hannah, their children, and the entire crew who escaped with him. It was signed by President Abraham Lincoln himself. With one act of daring, Robert Smalls had gone from property to citizen. But that wasn't enough for him. He wanted to serve, not just for himself, but for every black man still waiting in bondage. He saw the war as a tide that could carry his people forward if they had the courage to step in. Smalls joined the Navy as a civilian pilot and returned to the Planter, now re-outfitted with Union colors. In an ironic twist of fate, the very vessel that once hauled Confederate cannons now carried Union hopes, with Smalls at the wheel. He guided warships through the treacherous waters of the South Carolina and Georgia coasts, dodging mines he had once helped plant, now neutralized with his intimate knowledge. In 1863, during a naval operation near Folly Island, the white captain of the Planter panicked under Confederate fire and fled below deck. With no hesitation, Robert Smalls took command of the ship, under direct fire, and steered it to safety. That single act led the Union Navy to officially promote him. Though he couldn't hold military rank due to the color of his skin, he was now recognized with higher pay and full authority as the ship's pilot. That same year, the Union created the first black regiments, the United States Colored Troops. Robert Smalls' escape was one of the key events that had helped justify the decision. His action showed that black Americans were not only willing to fight for the Union, they were already leading the way. As Robert continued his service, he also became a powerful speaker. In northern cities like New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, he was welcomed as a war hero. He gave speeches at fundraisers, rallies, and abolitionist events. People who had never spoken to a black man before now listened to him with reverence. His presence challenged their assumptions. His words carried the weight of truth earned at sea. Yet for all his fame, Robert remained humble. He sent money home to support newly freed families. He advocated for the wives of other Union sailors. And he constantly reminded white officers and civilians that the war was not just about land or politics. It was about human lives, about the dignity of people who had been treated like cattle. He said more than once, "My race needs no special defense, for the past history of them in this country proves them to be the equal of any people anywhere." As the war dragged on, Robert saw the tide shift, both literally and metaphorically. More and more enslaved men escaped to Union lines. The Emancipation Proclamation had sent shockwaves through the South, and men like Smalls were living proof that freedom was not just an idea. It was a force that could change the world when paired with courage. The Planter, once a symbol of Confederate power, had now made more than a dozen successful missions under Union command. Each time, Smalls walked the decks with the knowledge that he had flipped the script. He had defied every expectation and rewritten history with his own hands. By the end of the war, Robert Smalls had served in nearly 20 major engagements. He had survived cannon fire, political battles, and death threats. But what mattered most to him was what lay ahead. Freedom had been won in war, but peace, real, lasting peace, would have to be built through justice, education, and representation. He had piloted ships. Now, he would begin piloting minds. And the next chapter of his life would take him off the water, into a different battlefield, one lined with ballots instead of bayonets. Chapter 5, Building Beaufort. When the war ended in 1865, Robert Smalls could have rested. He had defied the Confederacy, served the Union, and secured his family's freedom. But for Smalls, freedom wasn't the end of the road. It was the beginning of a far greater mission. He returned to Beaufort, South Carolina, the very town where he had been born into slavery. But this time, he walked its streets not as property, but as a free man. And not just free, victorious. One of the first things he did was buy the home of his former enslaver, the McKee House on Prince Street. It was poetic justice. The same plantation house where he had once been a barefoot boy serving in silence now belonged to him. He moved in with Hannah and their children, not as a show of power, but as a symbol of change. In every cracked floorboard and weathered shutter, Smalls saw not a monument to pain, but a platform for progress. But Robert didn't just settle into comfort. He immediately went to work for his people. During the Reconstruction era, South Carolina became a laboratory for what freedom could look like. With federal troops stationed across the South and the Freedmen's Bureau providing limited but important support, formerly enslaved people were finally able to organize, vote, and build lives with dignity. Smalls knew the foundation of that life had to be education. He threw himself into efforts to establish a free and compulsory public school system in South Carolina, one of the first of its kind in the South. Until then, it had been illegal to teach enslaved people to read and write. Smalls, who had taught himself out of scraps and whispers, wanted a different future for the next generation. One with classrooms, books, and trained teachers. He lobbied tirelessly in the state legislature for school funding, teacher training, and access for black children. Even as white supremacists pushed back with threats and violence. His stance was simple. A democracy could not survive if half its people remained uneducated. But he didn't stop at schools. Smalls became a prominent investor in local businesses, helping to build railroads, launch shipping ventures, and create job opportunities for newly freed black citizens. He co-founded a general store and helped secure land grants for families who had nothing but the shirts on their backs. He knew economic freedom was just as vital as political freedom. Without land, jobs, and the ability to feed their families, his people would be trapped in another form of slavery, this time hidden behind contracts, sharecropping, and debt. As Reconstruction efforts expanded, Smalls was selected as a delegate to the South Carolina Constitutional Convention in 1868. This was no ceremonial title. It was the front line of democracy's rebirth. In that room, he fought to enshrine civil rights into the state constitution. He pushed for equal legal protection, voting rights, and desegregation of public institutions. He faced fierce resistance from men who had once ruled the South unchallenged. Many mocked him. Others threatened his life. Some refused to sit in the same chamber as a black man. But Smalls stood his ground. He said, "Education means emancipation. It means light and liberty. It means the uplifting of the soul of man into the glorious light of truth, the light by which men can only be made free." His voice was steady, his purpose clear. And slowly, South Carolina began to change. Robert Smalls also became a vocal opponent of the rise of the Ku Klux Klan. As white resistance to Reconstruction grew more violent, Smalls publicly condemned racial terror. He partnered with federal authorities to identify and arrest Klan leaders. He knew that if fear was allowed to rule, freedom would be lost again. Despite constant threats against his life, he refused to back down. By 1870, he was elected to the South Carolina State Senate, where he continued to fight for the rights of freedmen. He focused on civil rights legislation, school expansion, and equal justice under the law. In Beaufort, his name became more than a symbol. It became a promise. To every black child who walked through the doors of a school, to every laborer who was paid fairly for the first time, to every voter who cast a ballot without a whip at his back, Robert Smalls was proof that the struggle was not in vain. He often walked the streets of his hometown with his coat buttoned high and his chin slightly raised, not in pride, but in purpose. Elders tipped their hats, children waved, and even some white neighbors, grudgingly or not, began to respect what he had built. But Smalls knew the winds were changing. Reconstruction was under attack. Federal support was waning. White Democrats were regaining power through intimidation and manipulation. Still, he pressed on. Because Robert Smalls had never accepted a world built on silence. He had learned long ago how to navigate storms, both at sea and on land. Now, his eyes turned toward Washington. The fight was far from over, and he was ready to take it to the halls of Congress. Chapter 6, In the Halls of Power. By the early 1870s, Robert Smalls had already accomplished more than most men do in a lifetime. War hero, businessman, community builder, and legislator. But now, he set his sights on the national stage. He believed the voices of formerly enslaved people belonged not just in schoolhouses and state halls, but in the very heart of American democracy, the United States Congress. In 1874, after serving in the South Carolina State Senate, Robert Smalls ran for a seat in the U.S. House of Representatives. The campaign was brutal. Racist mobs disrupted his rallies. White supremacist groups tried to intimidate voters. Smalls received anonymous threats, and violence was always just a shadow away. But he knew how to navigate danger. He had done it in Charleston Harbor, and now he would do it in the political arena. That November, he won and made history again. Robert Smalls became the first black man elected to Congress from South Carolina. He would go on to serve 5 terms, representing the state's 5th congressional district. And he walked into the Capitol not as a token, not as a guest, but as a man fully aware of the power he held and the eyes that were watching. In Washington, Smalls was determined to speak boldly and work relentlessly. He wasn't interested in handshakes or photo ops. He was there to legislate. His agenda was clear: protect black civil rights, expand education, promote economic opportunity, and root out the rot of racism baked into the federal system. One of his first acts was to fight for the enforcement of the 14th and 15th Amendments, ensuring that black men could vote and be protected under the law. While many Northern politicians were starting to distance themselves from Reconstruction, Smalls reminded them why the war had been fought in the first place. He introduced legislation to desegregate public transportation in the South, and he argued fiercely on the House floor for greater federal oversight in southern states, where local authorities refused to protect black citizens from violence. But Washington, like the South, was not immune to hate. Smalls faced ridicule from white congressmen who refused to sit beside him. He was often interrupted or dismissed mid-speech. Yet he pressed on. Always calm, always focused, never backing down. He also used his position to support veterans, especially black Union soldiers who had been denied pensions, recognition, or decent burials. He advocated for fair wages for federal workers, better conditions for sharecroppers, and land ownership for freedmen. One of his most poignant contributions was on the issue of public education. Smalls believed the future of America rested on literacy and learning. He used his national platform to argue that federal funding should support universal schooling, not just for white children in the North, but for every child across the South. His words echoed through the chamber. "We must ensure that ignorance is not inherited as a birthright for any child born on American soil." His work wasn't easy. He was often outvoted, sometimes blocked outright. Still, he knew that every speech, every vote, every document signed was a seed planted, and seeds grow. Back home in South Carolina, his victories made him a symbol of hope, but they also made him a target. The political tide was shifting. White Democrats, known as Redeemers, were regaining control in the South. They used voter suppression, gerrymandering, and violence to dismantle the gains of Reconstruction. One of Small's fiercest opponents was Benjamin Pitchfork Tillman, a rising political figure who openly championed white supremacy. Tillman's speeches stoked fear and hatred, and his allies worked tirelessly to discredit black politicians. Despite the hostility, Smalls kept winning re-election, at least for a time. But the resistance was mounting. In 1877, federal troops withdrew from the South under the Hayes Compromise. Reconstruction, in many ways, was over. Without military enforcement, many black citizens were pushed out of polling places, beaten, or worse. Entire districts were redrawn to dilute black voting power. In 1887, Smalls lost his congressional seat, not because the people stopped believing in him, but because the system had been rigged against him. Still, he didn't disappear. He remained a public servant, working with the U.S. Customs Service in Beaufort. He also continued speaking out at schools, churches, and civic halls. His message never changed. Freedom is fragile, and justice must be protected daily. Even in political defeat, Robert Smalls was never silenced. His legacy was written not just in speeches, but in stone, in the schools he helped open, the laws he helped pass, and the lives he helped free. He had walked through the White House, spoken with presidents, and stood on the floor of Congress. The same man who once swept decks as someone else's property, and every step he took reminded the nation of this truth. Democracy means nothing unless it belongs to everyone. Chapter 7, Legacy and Long, After the Fall. By the time the 20th century arrived, the tides of progress Robert Smalls had helped stir were crashing against a brutal undertow. Jim Crow laws swept across the South, locking black Americans out of voting booths, schools, juries, and justice itself. White supremacist rule, once forced into the shadows by Reconstruction, had clawed its way back into the light. But Robert Smalls was still standing. He had survived war, outwitted the Confederacy, built schools, passed laws, and walked the halls of Congress. Now, in his later years, he continued to serve his people, not with speeches and legislation, but with quiet, steadfast presence. from his modest but proud home on Prince Street in Beaufort, the very same house where he had once been enslaved, Smalls became a living monument. Children would stop to stare at him from the street. Freedmen, who had built lives from the ashes of slavery, would shake his hand in reverence. He never asked for praise. He offered guidance, stories, and warning. He worked for the U.S. Customs House for 2 decades after leaving Congress, holding one of the highest federal appointments a black man could have in the South at that time. He used the position to employ and protect black workers whenever possible, often against pressure from white superiors. But with the end of Reconstruction and the return of white political dominance, his influence, like that of so many black leaders of the era, began to dim in the public eye. Still, Smalls kept going. In speeches across South Carolina, he reminded young black men and women of the battles that had been fought for their freedom. He urged them not to give in to despair or fear. "We have been free long enough," he once said, "to become good citizens if we are treated justly." His voice was softer now, but his message never wavered. He watched as laws were passed to strip black citizens of the very rights he had bled to protect. Poll taxes, literacy tests, lynch mobs protected by silence. The same state that once sent him to Congress now passed laws to keep others like him from even voting. The betrayal ran deep. But Robert Smalls never lost faith. He believed history would swing again. That truth would outlive the liars. That children would one day walk through doors he had kicked open, even if they didn't know his name. In 1915, at the age of 75, Robert Smalls passed away in Beaufort. He was buried in the yard of Tabernacle Baptist Church, not far from the streets he once swept as a boy. Etched on his tombstone were the words, "My race needs no special defense, for the past history of them in this country proves them to be the equal of any people anywhere." For decades, his legacy was almost forgotten by the mainstream, buried under the weight of revisionist histories that erased black triumphs and sanitized white guilt. Schoolbooks seldom mentioned him. Monuments were built to generals who fought to keep him in chains, while his name faded into the background. But history, like the tides he once piloted, never stops moving. In the 21st century, Robert Smalls' name began to rise again. His story returned to classrooms, podcasts, documentaries, and community murals. In 2004, his home in Beaufort was declared a National Historic Landmark. In 2023, the U.S. Navy renamed a warship in his honor, the USS Robert Smalls, reclaiming a legacy first forged on the planter so many years ago. South Carolina, the state that once enslaved him, approved the placement of his statue on the grounds of the State House, the same capital that had once been closed to men like him. No longer a ghost in the margins of history, Robert Smalls now stood among the giants. And what did he stand for? Courage, vision, determination, the belief that justice is not a gift. It is a right earned, defended, and demanded by those who refuse to bow. Robert Smalls did not just escape slavery. He redefined what it meant to be free. He piloted a stolen warship through enemy waters. He piloted his people through Reconstruction. And in death, he continues to pilot the conscience of a nation still learning to live up to its promise. His legacy is not finished, because every time a child learns to read in a public school, every time a citizen casts a vote without fear, every time a voice rises against injustice, a part of Robert Smalls is there. still steering, still speaking, still free.